Congressman Mike Simpson. Welcome, Congressman. How are you?
It's good to be here. It's good to see the first snow of the year.
Well, yeah, it's good. I was joking with Julie earlier that you would have to come in on a sled with a team of mushing dogs. And
You know what's funny is Monday, I live out by Sage Lakes Golf Course, and I'm driving home, and Monday there were a couple of groups playing golf out there.
Yeah.
And I said to them, a little cold, isn't it? And they said, yeah, it's a little chilly, but it's not too bad. And now we got this.
Yeah, we do. And much needed water, though.
Much needed water. Yeah, we can't complain about this.
Yeah.
Other than we always complain about too much snow and roads.
We'll find
stuff,
something else to complain about.
Yeah, I've got to drive to Boise, and I wish it had waited a day. So we'll see. Gotcha. But it's okay. We need the water.
Yeah.
And they say they're getting good snow up in the mountains. So
okay. Good. We're actually going to talk with Brian Murdoch tomorrow, who's kind of, he's become the de facto water guru around here. So we look forward to that again tomorrow morning. But Congressman, give us an update. We know, that the House is kind of done there. Are you off for the whole week for President's Day?
Yep.
Is that okay?
Yeah, this whole week. And that's why I'm here. That's why I'll be in Boise this afternoon whenever we get there. Tomorrow in Boise and then fly back Saturday. The government is functioning. Homeland Security is not funded.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, normally we stay in Washington when we have a shutdown, just because it's the right thing to do. You never know when it's going to change and you need to be there and stuff. We're on what's called 48-hour notice. If the Senate were to do something, then we'd have 48 hours to get back there to vote on it. And so far, you know, the Senate wasn't going to do anything because they adjourned and went on their codels. Went to the Munich Security Conference, and some went to the Olympics, I think, and some other places. But I was surprised that they adjourned and left town. And if they left town, then there's no reason for us to stay.
So with it unfunded right now, what does that mean for our nation's security? I mean, Homeland Security is pretty important.
It is. And there are a lot of different agencies within Homeland Security. ICE, border security, that type of thing. The funny thing is that's what the Democrats that won't vote for this are complaining about. They don't want to fund ICE. ICE has been funded through like 2028 with the One Big Beautiful Bill.
Yeah.
So shutting down Homeland Security won't shut down ICE, won't affect ICE. They'll still have the funding. But who it will affect is FEMA. And we've had these snowstorms all across this country, and there are disaster areas that they need this FEMA funding. Well, they've shut down FEMA, and FEMA doesn't have the resources necessary to go in and address that. They shut down the Coast Guard. Now, the Coast Guard is TSA is shut down also. Those people are working, but they're unpaid.
Yep.
They will get pay, and fortunately, their next paycheck is not due, I think, till March 4th. So we need to get this resolved by March 4th. Otherwise, they don't get that paycheck. If it was like another 2 weeks, they'd get back pay for it. We always pay the federal employees that are laid off that way.
Yeah.
But it means that in 2 weeks, if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you don't get the paycheck, that's a tough thing. So we need to get this resolved as soon as possible. There are some negotiations going on between the White House and Senate Democrats. Senate Democrats want some things that we just can't do, that don't make sense. There are some issues like body cameras that they wanted. At first they wanted them, then they didn't want them. Now they want them again, I guess. We're okay with that. In fact, remember when they put body cameras on police officers? At first the police departments were opposed to that. They, we don't want somebody looking over our shoulder or anything. Then what they found out is when they put body cameras on, it justified most of what they were doing.
Yeah.
And now they're fine with it. And I think the same would be true with ICE. So body cameras will be something that comes on, and then we will also have some of the other issues. But we just can't go as far as what some of the Democrats want to do. They essentially want ICE to be ineffectual and not do their job.
This may reveal my own naivety here, but I always thought the Coast Guard was part of our defense, like they were one of the branches of the military. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, they are kind of a branch. Well, that's a good question. They are a branch of the military. We consider them that. I mean, they are the Coast Guard, and they're in Homeland Security, And you got to remember the Department of Homeland Security after 9/11 was formed in that we were just trying to cabal together different agencies that we thought would fit in there. And we think, I think that it's time that we re-examine whether some of these agencies ought to be in Homeland Security or not. And Coast Guard would be one of those.
Yeah. Okay.
I contended during the last shutdown that the Democrats kind of won the information war on that. And even though what they were pushing was not quite accurate, I felt like a lot of the mainstream media and everything got on board. And the Democrats probably did win the information war just barely, just slightly.
Yeah.
I don't see any wins for them stopping the funding of FEMA, the funding of the Coast Guard, the funding. I don't see where they're going with this second shutdown. They're not. Nobody's even talking about it.
Well, their base is very insistent on not funding ICE and getting ICE to stop doing what they're doing and stuff like that. And I will tell you, you know, I don't like to see anybody get killed. And these two people that died in Minneapolis, I don't like to see any of the protesters get killed or the agitators get killed. And believe me, these are not just protesters. There were agitators in there that are being paid that whose goal is to create an incident so that they can all be out there with the cameras and it can be on TV and all that kind of stuff. And I don't like to see them get killed. But what I really don't like to see is American citizens get killed by illegal people that are here that have committed crimes of murder and rape and child pornography and child slavery and that kind of stuff. That's what we've got to stop. And that's what ICE is trying to do. We are trying to correct or solve a problem that was created over the last 4 years by the Biden administration that just let people, up to 20 million people, illegally come across the border and not know who the heck they were. It's a disaster. And we're trying to correct that problem, and now we're being criticized for it. When you say who won the messaging war during the 43-day shutdown, the Democrats, if you remember at that time, the whole message was health care and the expanded health care benefits. And when you try to explain what the health care subsidies were that are currently in place and still are in place versus the expanded ones that went in that the Democrats put in and put a sunset date on, you kind of lose people. And people are concerned about the cost of health care. But ever since this has started to happen in Minneapolis, I haven't heard any of the Democrats talk about health care costs.
Yeah.
None of them. And I will tell you, and this is my own personal belief, the problem that you saw in Minneapolis was created by three people, actually. The governor, Waltz, who is actually coming here to speak to the Democratic Jefferson Jackson days, which just stuns me. But Waltz, the attorney general, and the governor or the mayor of Minneapolis, because they would not let their police officers go out and do crowd control. You noticed when Tom Horman came to Minneapolis and started working with them, and they made an agreement that the police department would do crowd control, that what happened is you haven't seen any of those riots now because ICE is not trained in crowd control. And so when you had these protesters, the police should have been out there protecting them, and the police wanted to, but the mayor and the governor wouldn't let them. And consequently, it created a situation where, unfortunately, two people got killed. And I think if you had allowed them to go out and do their job, the police department, which they wanted to do, you would have seen a whole different situation occur up there. ICE is – their job is to go get criminals, pick them up, deport them if they're deportable or other things like that. That's their job. It's not crowd control. That's what the police department does. Even in New York, you will notice every time that there's a protest when ICE comes around, it's the New York Police Department that is doing the crowd control. And that's what should have happened there. So when they come and say, when Minneapolis, the governor comes and says, oh, we want the federal government to pay for all this stuff. You know, if you'd have done your job as governor or as mayor or as attorney general of Minnesota, this would not have happened. So they're whistling Dixie.
Well, nothing is ever their fault. I did want to ask you, Congressman, the wisdom of passing the spending bills one by one is very apparent now, because Julie's right. Nobody's talking about the shutdown because there's not really a shutdown. There's just an underfunded part of the government now. That really was an important shift by the Republicans to say, okay, we're gonna fund the government, but we've got to do it a piece at a time.
It was most of our members on our conference, if not all of our members on our conference, were so tired of omnibuses. That's all of the appropriations bills getting wrapped into one bill at the end of the year because we didn't get them done on time, and so we pass it as an omnibus. That's the wrong way to go because you can't have concentration on very specific parts, very specific bills and that type of stuff. So we've tried to get it back to what we call regular order, and that is individual bills. We're not there yet. We still passed like two bills in one plan and three in another and that kind of stuff. Mini buses, we call them, instead of omnibuses.
Yeah.
We're trying to get back to where we do each individual bill, as it should be, as it was done when I first came. And that takes a lot of time, but it's the right way to do it. Because then if you got a problem with a bill because it's got something in it you don't like, you can offer an amendment to get rid of it, and you'll either win or lose. That's how it should be.
Yeah.
I should be able to offer an amendment to an appropriation bill if it's got something in it that I disagree with, even if I'm the only one that votes for it. If I feel that it's representing my constituents, I ought to be able to offer that amendment. And right now, we've got away from that, and we're working hard to get back to that.
We've got a couple of news stories that ran this week or about the last 7 days in East Idaho that talked about layoffs at the site at the INL. I would love for you to give us an update on what you know about funding at the INL, and should East Idahoans be concerned about, you know, further layoffs at the INL or any damages that will be done by lack of funding for the INL?
You know, I haven't talked to John out there yet, and I will do that this week about what's going on. But what it is the INL is continually going through, and always has gone through, a period where they're right-sizing the workforce and making sure that it is in the areas that they need them. Because they will have an increase in a budget in, say, from Homeland Security dealing with cybersecurity, and they'll need more people there and not as many people over here. So they're continually changing that, and they always have. And sometimes that means you go through some involuntary layoffs. Usually they can handle it by going through voluntary layoffs and stuff. I'm sure that they're very cognizant of the impact that layoffs have both on the INL and on Southeast Idaho. But I'll be talking to him later on about this. I can tell you that the INL budget, the energy and water budget that funds the INL, was a very good budget this year for the Idaho National Lab. And so I think they're going to be fine. In fact, I think you're going to see the INL grow substantially over the next few years.
All right. We're talking with Congressman Mike Simpson. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and continue the discussion with the congressman after this on News Talk 107.9. All right, 9:23, News Talk 107.9, Neil Larson, Julie Mason, and Congressman Mike Simpson in town. Most of us celebrate President's Day, but in Congress, they take a whole week off. So,
oh, yeah.
You know. No, but
that's because, especially in Idaho, but in many states.
Yeah.
And frankly, this is, I think, really good for Republicans.
Yeah.
We have Lincoln Days that go on for a couple months.
That's true.
And every community, it seems like, almost has one.
Yep.
Jefferson Jackson Day, they have a Jefferson Jackson Day in Boise. And that's it.
Yeah.
So it's good for Republicans because it's those local people that make your party work.
Yeah.
And we try to go to as many as I can. And I know that the senators and Representative Fulcher does also. And we try to get around to as many of them. And President's Week is about the only time we can get around him. But there's not very many this week going on. Couple weeks coming after that, there's going to be a lot of them.
I was just going to say, maybe they take the whole week off because everyone in Congress wants to become the president. Is that?
Well, you know, the old saying, every morning a senator shaves the face of the next president. You
know? Yeah, that's a good point. Well, we were just talking off air about the little water battle we had with Utah the last few weeks. It appears to be over, that Utah has completely backed off this idea. But it is interesting how, the fuel, not the water. We actually brought up the water because they were wanting to tax the fuel. I'd love your thoughts on this because before you came in this morning, we had talked about it, just a follow-up of how it ended. And I thought, I wonder if this spilled over into any, federal level discussions on this. And, you know, it did, because there's an interstate commerce angle on this and all of that. So,
well, a couple of weeks ago when this first broke, I hadn't heard about it at all. The governor and lieutenant governor and pro tem and Speaker Moyle called me over to the governor's office just before I was driving back to Idle Falls. And we went over and sat down. They explained to me what Utah was trying to do. And they told me that they had talked to their people that they knew in the Utah legislature and stuff like that. And everybody has said, I don't think we can stop this. This just has too much support. And I heard that the governor, Governor Cox of Utah, while he didn't like it, said he didn't think he could stop it. And so we were talking about what to do about it. And the issue of putting a, you know, I suggested that they just put a toll booth on the interstate on I-15. And, yeah. Of course, that would be unconstitutional, but they talked about water and the fact that the Bear River is the only river that flows into the Great Salt Lake. They wanted it filled for the Olympics when it comes to Salt Lake and stuff. We still have some water rights in the Bear River that we could pump that river into the Snake River Basin or somewhere else.
Yeah.
And you just don't want to get in this kind of a war. And when I went back to Utah, and what they wanted me to do is they asked what I could do. And I'm from, I don't know, you tell me. And I believe, and I think most of them believe, that what Utah was proposing was unconstitutional. So we were going to draft a bill that would have prevented that. That would have been a hard bill to pass in Congress, probably, because there's a lot of states that have refineries that, if this had been successful, would have gone down that same route.
Yeah.
And as I told you during the break, if you're in Louisiana and you do all the refining down there, you could probably eliminate all of your state taxes by having other states pay the taxes and stuff. So that just didn't make much sense. I think it's unconstitutional. We were drafting a bill to prevent this from happening, but looks like it's over, and that's a good thing. We don't want to get in a fight with Utah. That's just not necessary.
Yeah, no. Well, not any more than we already have.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Somebody brought up, though, we were talking about this earlier, that maybe we should look at building our own refinery. And I looked it up a few weeks ago. It's billions of, like, several billion dollars to build a refinery.
Yep.
But at some point, if the population of Idaho increases, would it start to make economic sense to look at doing that?
I wouldn't be surprised. I will tell you that I get stopped by people from Idaho on when I'm going through the airports and stuff like that. A guy stopped me from to talk to me from Driggs the other day. And he said, why is the gas prices in Idaho higher than the rest of the nation? Because we have pretty high gas prices in Idaho. Yeah. And so as I understand it, and he said he's talked to the attorney general, he's talked to all these different people about what they can do about it and what's causing it. And what he, what I understand from talking to people in the industry is the problem is Idaho doesn't have any refineries. All of our gas gets pumped in through pipelines and trucking and other means.
Yeah.
And consequently that costs money. When I first moved to St. Louis to go to dental school, I drive in a U-Haul, my wife's behind me in the car, and we'd leave here and we go down through Soda Springs to grab the interstate by Kemmer, you know? And when we left Soda Springs, I said, I better get some gas now because that'll be the price. When you get closer to St. Louis, it's going to get really expensive. Highest price gas that I bought all the way to St. Louis was in Soda Springs, Idaho. Mm. But you think about it, that's, you know, it's harder to get the gas to Soda Springs and to the rest of Idaho. And that's one of the reasons that we have high gas prices in this state. And a refinery might help.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Democrats in Boise bringing in Governor Tim Walz. You have kind of a unique position here because Governor Tim Walz was just one step away from being the vice president, one vote away. And then we also, now we're going to bring them to the Democrat Party and you represent Idaho. So give us what you think about why would they even choose to do this with the massive failure that existed in November?
My staff brought me in the clip that he was coming to speak to the Jefferson Jackson Days in Boise and that it was sold out and that they were trying to get more tickets and stuff. I couldn't say anything for about 5 minutes because I couldn't believe it. And I'm sitting there kind of going, I mean, that's like the PTA inviting Ted Bundy to come and talk to you. I mean, it's just, I couldn't believe it. I served with him in Congress and I always thought he was kind of weird and different in Congress, not what I would call a great congressman. And then he ran for governor, and I was surprised when they elected him as governor. And then I was shocked when Kamala Harris selected him as vice president. But this guy is—I don't know what the Democrats in Idaho are thinking.
We interviewed Senator James Ruckty, state senator.
Yeah,
and asked him. The best he could come back with was, "Well, I don't sit on the committee that makes those decisions."
I will tell you when they. Well, a good friend of mine is Betty McCollum from Minnesota. And she's a Democrat. She's been on the Appropriations Committee with me for years. She is the ranking member on the Defense Appropriation Committee. And if the Democrats were to take over, she would be the chairman of that committee. But she's what I would call a normal Democrat, you know. And when they nominated him for vice president, I just texted her and said, Tim Walz, and put a question mark behind it. The only thing she could respond, and she's a pretty good friend with Tim Walz, the only thing she could say in response was, he likes dogs. So, I mean, that's about it, you know?
Yeah. That's
but it was, it shocked me, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. All right. News break right now. We'll take that break. We'll come back and continue. How much time you got? Another segment with this? Okay. All right. We'll do one more segment after this on News Talk 107.9. All right. It's 9:37 now on News Talk 107.9. I think I was just misinterpreted in this room because Congressman Simpson said we could talk about taxes, and I think my official reaction to that was, but I was actually a little bit distracted. But it is tax season, and a lot of provisions in the big, beautiful bill are going to be coming online that I think a lot of people are going to be pleasantly surprised when they file their taxes.
Yes, they are.
But we're not seeing the reduction in revenue, though.
Exactly. It is tax returns that I read the other day are up 11%. Each tax return is up 11%, across the board. It's more money back into people's pockets, and they believe it'll be around 20% by the time everybody files some stuff, which is a lot of money back in consumers' pockets, which is important for the economy and every business out here. We just went yesterday to a car dealership, and most people don't even know this, but if you buy a car, you could have bought it after December 1st of last year. You can write off up to $10,000 of the interest on a loan that you take out on that car.
Mm.
And that goes through 2028, I think it is. So, you know, I would think that that would spur automobile sales as long as the car was assembled in the United States.
Okay.
We went to the car dealership to find out what assembled in the United States means, because there's no car that's fully built in the United States. I think Tesla is probably the only one. But everything else is parts come from other places. But the final assembly has to be in the United States. And we were talking to a Volkswagen dealer out here, Toyota Volkswagen, and they had a car in their showroom that has parts from everywhere, but it is assembled in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So it qualifies. Word needs to get out to people that if they're looking at buying a car, now is the time to do it. Now, there is an income qualification on it, $100,000 or $200,000 if you file jointly, you qualify for that. So you can, you know, write off the interest that you pay on that car, and that's a good thing. And there's a lot of provisions like that that are going to kick in. The increased child tax credit, there's increases to help with daycare and that kind of stuff, child care, that are really going to cook in. I think you're going to see this economy grow at 4 to 5% over the next year.
Yeah. One question I do want to ask you, speaking of taxation and budget and spending, there is a robust discussion among the states and legislatures for an Article 5 convention, and it seems like the idea of a constitutional amendment requiring a federal balanced budget, which I think would create a lot of panic in the House and the Senate and in Washington, D.C. So I'd love your perspective on this state-level effort to require you and your colleagues to balance the federal budget every year.
I've always supported a balanced budget amendment, and I wish we had one. And every time one comes to the floor, I vote for it. Never gets enough votes to pass. The last time it came as close as it did was when Larry Craig was a senator, and he had one. I was Speaker of the House here in Idaho. We were prepared to, once it passed, be the first state to adopt a balanced budget amendment and stuff, but then lost by one vote. That's how close it came. Hasn't come close since. The problem with an Article 5 convention, and this is just my perspective from the studying I've done and stuff, is that I don't know that you can control the limits of an Article 5 convention. Even if the call for the convention is to only consider a balanced budget amendment, I don't know if you can control that. Because the only history we have is when they decided that they were going to amend the Articles of Confederation. And so the state sent people to the convention, and what they did is they threw out the Articles of Convention, Articles of Confederation, and wrote the Constitution, which was much broader. In fact, a lot of people in the states were opposed to the Constitution because it went too far from what the convention was called for.
Yeah.
So that's my only concern there. But if you talk to the people proposing the Article 5 convention, they will tell you we don't want one. We just want to push it to the point where Congress has to act for fear of there being one. And, you know, maybe that's a legitimate argument, but that's kind of playing with fire.
Well, I think that is playing with fire. Because what happens if you get one?
Yeah. What happens if you get one? And then all of a sudden coming out of a convention, do you have a Second Amendment? I would be surprised if there was. You know, I mean, they could. And the real question is, can you limit it? Can you limit a convention to just a balanced budget amendment? I would like to see Congress pass one and get it on the books. And in reality, this is maybe not the right thing to say, but we don't need one. Congress could balance the budget now if they wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, it would take a few years, but if we got the right people elected that are willing to reduce spending and address the entitlement programs, we could do it without a balanced budget amendment, but I think it's going to take a balanced budget amendment to get it done.
Yeah.
If you were looking at the entitlement programs as a whole, like a gigantic pie, and Trump has been trying to whittle away those with the work of Congress, how much of the pie have we taken out?
None.
Okay.
I mean, very, very, a sliver. Uh-huh. Out of the total spending of the federal government, the total budget, unified budget of both discretionary spending, which is everything you think of as government, and entitlement programs, 72% of it is entitlement programs, and that's mainly Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. 30, 40 years ago, it was just the reverse. It was 30% entitlement, 70% discretionary. We actually control discretionary spending pretty well. We've been trying to boost defense spending because we're behind in defense spending, and we've been trying to boost that, but we've cut other things. For 10 years, between 2008 and 2018, flat funded discretionary spending. If somebody would have told me you're going to do that, I said you're crazy. That's impossible, because when you think of inflation and stuff, that's a reduction in spending. But we flat funded it for 10 years, but the debt kept going up because of entitlement spending kept growing. You will not balance this budget until you address the entitlement programs in this country. That means, and the three big ones are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Yeah.
And that's not to take anything away from people that have now, but you've got to change it for the future generations. If you talk to young people today, they will tell you, and I've seen the poll of this, they will tell you that they believe they're more likely to see an alien than they are to get Social Security. And if we don't do something, they're going to be right. Because in, 6 years, Social Security goes bankrupt? I mean, we're already spending more in Social Security than we take in right now.
Yeah.
And when it goes bankrupt, there's a law that it's an automatic, I think, 27% cut in Social Security benefits. So we got to make some changes, and we can do it while protecting those people that are currently on Social Security or near retirement and that kind of stuff. But you got to change it for the future generations, and young people want to do that. It's the older people that are afraid of it.
I know it's a different animal, but right now what's happening in the state budget discussion, like I'm amazed at how, I mean, we're talking about low single digit cuts, and they act like the we're having a nuclear war.
Like we need a tourniquet. Yeah.
And so when you look at it on the federal level, any discussion about trimming back these entitlement programs, it's going to be thermonuclear war.
That's
like
what it is.
It is such a political difficulty once this addiction to government spending has been entrenched. It's very difficult to reverse that.
There's an old saying that there's nothing on earth as permanent as a temporary government program. And that's exactly what it is. That's what happened with the enhanced Obamacare subsidies and stuff. You know, once it's there, how do you get rid of it? Well, it was hard, by not funding it. And we got accused of not caring about old people and sick people and all that kind of stuff. None of that's true. But I put together me and Steny Hoyer, who is a good friend of mine, Democrat from Maryland. We don't agree on a lot of stuff, but we realized that there's a problem. And we put together what was called the Go Big Coalition, worked on it for a number of years, trying to address the entitlement programs and the overall budget deficit and stuff and what it was going to take. And I'll tell you what, we brought a bill to the floor. One of the we had about eight Republicans, eight Democrats working on this committee and stuff. One of the members decided to bring what we had been working on to the floor as a budget resolution, got 37 votes out of 435, wow. You know, because it is tough votes. And what you do is if members of Congress will come up, every one of them know that the problem, that there's a problem here and that we've got to address it. But guess what? Social Security doesn't run out for, what did I say, 6, 8 years, something like that. And so they sit here and go, well, we'll let the next Congress take care of that or the one after that. You know, we've been doing that for 30 years.
Yeah.
Even though we've known it's a problem. And every year you put off trying to address this problem, the answers become more dramatic than they would before.
Yeah.
So
it gets more difficult.
And it's going to take both Republicans and Democrats to work on this. It's like when Tip O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker of the House from Massachusetts, and Ronald Reagan got together. They saved Social Security for a generation. They did it by increasing the tax rate a little bit in Social Security and increasing the retirement age. Saved it for a generation. And if you'd listen to their press conferences afterwards, Tip O'Neill would say, that damn President Reagan made me increase the retirement age, you know, by a year or so. And Ronald Reagan, sitting right next to him, would say, that damn Tip O'Neill made me increase the tax rate and stuff. So, that's right. Called a compromise.
Yeah.
And that's how it worked and saved. I'm saying there are a lot of ideas out there on Social Security that will not affect the people that are currently on or near it, but we've got to have the courage to do it.
Yeah. Really quick on Obamacare. I felt like through that whole government shutdown, all of that, it had reached a pain point where nearly everyone agrees healthcare is way too expensive in this yep. country. And you can blame, even the Democrats are blaming Obamacare.
Yep.
They may not state it quite that blatantly, but everyone can see the problem that this was a system that Obama put in place that was just not going to be sustainable over time. Do you think we've reached that pain point now that it will be an impetus that we can reform healthcare in the U.S. and make it more affordable, say within the next 3 to 5 years?
I hope so. It's absolutely necessary. And the one argument that I think was the most potent against extending the healthcare subsidies was it didn't do anything to bring down the cost of healthcare. In fact, it probably raised the cost of healthcare. It's like the example I use is I voted against and have repeatedly voted against paying off student loans, college student loans, even though Biden kept trying to do it and kept trying to do it. The problem is we got to reduce the cost of college.
Yeah.
And if you pay off the student loans, what does the administration of the college do? Go, hey, we can raise the rates because our students aren't paying for it. The federal government's paying for it, you know, and it will actually raise the cost of college. That's why I voted against it more than anything. It makes me sick that someone graduates from college and has $500,000 in debt. We got to change that. But you got to change it by changing the cost of college. Same thing with healthcare. You got to have people more involved in their own healthcare instead of thinking that someone else, an insurance company or whoever, is paying for it. You've got to decide whether, you know, I got a sniffly. Do I really need to go to the doctor for this sniffly nose? Well, if the insurance company is paying for it, sure, I'll go.
Yeah.
Or why is this doctor charging, you know, X number of dollars for a procedure, and the doctor down the street's only charging 2/3 of that?
Yeah.
Why would I go to the one that's charging 2/3 if the insurance company's paying for it?
Yeah.
You got to get people involved again. And that's what we're trying to do. And there's a lot of bills out there that Republicans have proposed that will help do that. And one of them that I'm most excited about is the health savings account, where you put money into a health savings account, and if you use it, great. You use it for healthcare. You put it in tax-free. When it comes out, you can use it for healthcare. If you don't need it for healthcare, you can take it out as income and stuff. So, I mean, it's a good thing. It's there's a lot of ideas out there that we've got to coalesce behind a bill and get it done.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, we've consistently kind of floated an idea here about Medicaid, that if Medicaid had a copay attached to it, like we all have to do with our regular insurance, that we would actually see hospital ER visits go down, certain visits go down, because there wouldn't be that intention of, well, I can go whenever I want to go because it's free.
Yep.
Would you be supportive of something like that?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, it, I mean, it is anything that gets people involved in the decision making and it affects their pocketbook. That's what's going to change healthcare in the future. It's what's going to change college costs in the future and a lot of other things. We got to get people making decisions instead of third parties.
Yeah. All right. Congressman Mike Simpson, thank you for your time.
Hey, good to be with you again.
All right. Okay. Look forward to chatting with you again soon.
You bet.